Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and thank you for joining today's teleconference, Why the Stock Market is Increasingly Volatile and What You Can Do About It. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties, and actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS's most recent outlook and the ARS website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I'll turn the call over to Stephen Burke, Managing Partner for ARS Investment Partners. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Jason. Investor sentiment tends to swing between two extremes, that of fear and that of greed. We got a taste of fear in the fourth quarter when we had a significant downdraft in the market, which was highlighted by the worst December returns in the market since 1931. Only to be followed by January, which saw the best returns for the month of January in over three decades. Today, the emotion that probably best describes the emotion of market participants is that of confusion. The current chaotic and unorthodox political environment we're experiencing against a slowing global economy, growing social stresses, and unprecedented market conditions leads to a very interesting setup for investors and one that creates some challenges. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us today. As Jason said, I'm Stephen Burke, and I'm the managing partner of ARS. I'm joined on this call by Sean Wallace and Ross Taylor, two of my partners and our senior portfolio managers. I'm going to take a crack at providing some of the whys to the volatility and talk a little bit about our investment outlook and key investment themes. Sean will then discuss our range of capabilities with a focus on our exchange-traded fund offering. And then Russ will follow up with an introduction to our core equity strategy, which, like the exchange-traded fund strategies, has provided strong returns with lower risk characteristics in the market. So let's get started. I think it's important to share with you our investment approach. Since our inception in 1971, we've viewed the market as a medium of exchange where you swap dollars for shares of ownership of businesses in the leading companies in the world. The result is you're in an auction market that creates regular and temporary mispricings of securities, and those mispricings create opportunities for investors, fundamental to how we think about managing money. Our investment philosophy has always been to buy the most earnings, assets, and cash flows for the fewest dollars in the companies of the beneficiaries of the most powerful secular trends. Each day, we work to do four things: define the global environment and determine where capital is going to flow, identify the undervalued businesses that are going to benefit, build portfolios around the goals and tolerance for clients, and then manage risk throughout the process. So let's talk about volatility for a minute. I'd like to start by saying what we've seen over the last 10 years is that volatility has been artificially suppressed due to the highly accommodative monetary policies that have been at work, which were designed to stimulate assets while working through a serious debt problem and financial crisis. So as monetary policy has begun to change, you've started to see an increase in volatility. We've always had volatility in the market. Sometimes it gets suppressed by other forces. At the same time, adding to volatility last year was a shift from a global economy that was in a synchronized growth pattern. All economies were doing well coming into the year, to one where we started to see divergences in the growth and a slowdown in growth relative to the previous year. That created some uncertainty for the market participants as well. Adding to that, monetary policy was going through a transition, particularly that of the U.S., where we were becoming somewhat less accommodative, and that was creating divergences between our policies and the policies of other central banks. Add to that the unusual political backdrop that we're facing and growing social stresses, and you have what would lead to periods of episodic volatility. And we want to bear in mind that it's ironic that when we talk to clients, volatility is of great concern when the market's going down. It's less of a concern when the market's going up. It's our job to help keep perspective on it, and that's what we're trying to offer today. Let me touch on our outlook for 19 and some of the key highlights of that. And given the limited time, it's not going to be as inclusive as our outlooks are. But there are three key elements for our outlook for this year coming into the year. The first was that we felt that it's in the best interest of central banks and governments around the world to do all they can to avoid a recession and extend the business cycle. In the U.S., we're currently in the midst of the second longest expansion in history, and we expect that there will be a continuation of that, and the Fed's given us an indication recently by backing off from some of their less accommodative monetary plans. So we expect central banks around the world and governments around the world to do their best to avoid a recession. China, the second largest economy, is doing several stimulus measures to help offset their slowdown. We expect to see that more and more. And you heard today from Europe, the European Central Bank has mentioned that their next policy move may be the lower rates, as they're having some slowing in their area. The second key element of our outlook was that coming into the year, the S&P, because of the decline in the fourth quarter, was selling for a near five-year low in valuation. And that actually creates some opportunities. Our outlook for equities is generally very constructive. A lot of that's due to the fact that we think corporate earnings are going to continue to grow, maybe at a slower rate, absolutely at a slower rate than last year, but they're doing it against a backdrop of very muted inflationary pressures and low interest rates, historically low interest rates. Those two characteristics combined give us some very positive views of the market, and more specifically, targeted areas in the market that we'll talk about next. The third key characteristic is, in our view, that volatility will be a bigger part of the market participant, market action going forward, and we're very confident that that will be a bigger feature for the foreseeable future. But we are positive on the outlook, particularly for the areas that I'm going to touch on in a few minutes. But that positive outlook has to be managed without the complacency that often occurs for investors. And that is, we feel that there are certain risks to the continuation of it that may be short-term in nature. And let me touch on four of them. Big risk coming up in the near term is that the government can't come to an agreement and avoid a second shutdown. We expect that that's a lower risk probability, but given the ideological approaches of both parties, not one that you can take lightly. The second issue, and we're seeing that in the market action today, is the March 1st deadline for the U.S. and China to avoid tariff increases, further tariff increases. Today, Larry Kudlow announced that they're not that close, followed by a view that President Trump is not going to meet with President Xi before the March 1st deadline. A lot of this may be posturing, but it's certainly not an area that people can view as a foregone conclusion that a deal will be reached. We think that there's likely going to be an extension of the deadlines, that there'll be more room for negotiation. We still believe it's in everyone's best interest to find a way to work through the issues between the U.S. and China. But one of the major issues that's been highlighted by the current administration and voiced about others around the world gets to the heart of the Chinese economic model, which will create major problems that they're not going to back down on. The others are around the theft of intellectual property, which is an area that more work certainly can be done on. The other big date that we're facing is March 29th, which is the date that the United Kingdom and the European Union need to reach an agreement on how the UK is going to leave the European Union. That has been not a smooth process to date, and the actions of those involved has not inspired confidence that a deal will be reached in time. We're hopeful that there's an extension of that deadline as well, but ideology, again, is a big part, and comments from the European Union president today were somewhat inflammatory, as he thought there was a special place in hell for the people who were supportive of leaving the EU without a positive plan for how they were going to do that. So you can get a sense of the positioning that's going on for many of these people. The fourth area that would have you not become complacent is the fact that we're going to come against a debt ceiling for the U.S., and those always become somewhat tenuous, and while the right thing's always done eventually, it's usually not the first thing that's done. So there's no reason to be complacent there. But let's talk about the areas that we're excited about, because there are some really spectacular and very powerful secular trends that will be areas that are going to attract significant capital going forward. The first is in tech. And we think over the next 24 to 36 months, we're going to see technological advances that will be unlike any we've seen previously. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said last year that the rate of change has never been this great and will never be this slow again. And as we look at the company, what companies are doing from a technological perspective, we share that view. Take 5G, for instance. The spend on 5G over the next several years will be close to $90 billion, with China and the U.S. leading the way, with China spending roughly $420 billion and the U.S. estimated to spend $280 billion. 5G is going to change the way businesses operate and the way we live our lives. There are big changes coming, and it will have some ramifications for the way industry works, and I just highlight a couple. First of all, there's going to be a dramatic increase in the number of devices that are we're going to be able to access information on. To put it in perspective, Ericsson reports that we currently have 18 billion connected devices in the, around the world. That's projected to grow by 2020 to 28.5 billion connected devices. For perspective, the population of the world at that time is estimated to be slightly over 8 billion people, so more than three devices per person. And remember that several don't have internet access and many don't have electricity still. Internet traffic is going to grow at, a, at an unprecedented rate too, as they're anticipating a threefold increase in internet traffic to 396 exabytes a month. To put that in perspective, 396 exabytes a month is equivalent to downloading 99 trillion DVDs on a monthly basis, a big number. I think I might have mentioned 900 billion, not 90 billion for the total spend, so I apologize for that. Big money being spent in that area. 5G is going to impact a lot of areas. There are other areas in the tech area that we're very positive on. I'll touch on a couple of them. The first is cloud. As much as investments have gone into the cloud, we still think it's in the very early stages of development, and there's going to be more opportunities to grow out of that. Along the lines of devices, Verizon reported that as we move to 5G, many of the devices that are in use now are going to have to be replaced to meet the 5G standard. For a little perspective on that, Apple has sold roughly a billion devices since the first iPhone came out, so some portion of those are going to have to be replaced. We also like data centers, we like storage, we like the semiconductor and capital equipment companies as well. Moving on to the next big theme for us, it's healthcare. And to put healthcare in perspective, the 60-plus age group is the fastest-growing demographic globally. Japan alone has 69,000 people who are over 100 years old. It's a growing part of the population. It's changing the way we think about things. So there are significant secular tailwinds behind the healthcare space. The need for medical devices, for increased medicines, for other areas around to support the healthcare system are all going to see increased spend going to it with much higher volumes as we move forward. Technology is a big driver in all the areas that we're looking at. Healthcare is one of them. I'll add to it the defense industry as the next area that we're looking at. Defense is very heavily tech-driven. Spending is increasing in the U.S. and elsewhere after several years of sequestration. There's roughly $1.7 trillion spent annually on the defense industry, and that's only going to grow. The U.S. is increasing their spend. China is also increasing their spend. We're the two leaders in that area. But those are followed by Saudi Arabia, Russia, and India. And those top five nations account for 60% of global defense spend. And the areas that defense spending are growing are in different areas than we've had before. Aside from the fact that most armies need to modernize and bring in drones and other things, you're also starting to see an increased emphasis on space heard in the State of the Union. You're also seeing an increased emphasis on cybersecurity. Much of that comes out of the defense industry. Just as a note, you can purchase by the entire defense, seven largest companies in the defense industry for roughly $450 billion. The representation of aerospace and defense in the S&P is about 2.4%. It's not enough, and we believe that investors should hold much bigger positions there. And the last big theme that we're focused on is special situations. Companies are being faced with choices how they're going to compete, and in some cases how they're going to survive as industry after industry is being disrupted. That's going to lead to some challenging choices where companies are going to spin off parts of their business, make acquisitions, and the like. In fact, today's transaction between BB&T and SunTrust Banks, a big theme that was driving the merger is the need to spend more on technology. To put it in perspective, they're competing with J.P. Morgan and Citibank, who combined are going to spend close to $20 billion on technology this year. So banks around the country and in every industry are going to look to how they're going to have to increase the spend. So we expect to see a continuation and maybe possibly an acceleration of the spending and merger and acquisition activities that are going to go on. And for a little perspective on that, corporations are sitting on over $2 trillion in cash, and private equity firms are sitting on about $1.7 trillion, and that money is looking to find a home where it's going to generate greater returns. So while there's some challenges in the market, we expect to see greater volatility, we still think there's some very powerful secular trends that investors will benefit by taking advantage of over the coming years. It's also important to keep in mind that volatility is good for you in both directions, as long as you understand that the mispricings that are created are going to be regular and temporary and are ready to take advantage of it. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my partner, Sean Wallace.
Thanks, Stephen. Before I get started, I just wanted to touch on a quick housekeeping item. You received an email with a link to a presentation that provided some background on the strategies that we're going to talk about today. If for whatever reason you had difficulty launching the link, or you just missed the link and you didn't have an opportunity to download the materials, no worries. Well, we're not going to be referencing the presentation during the call today. But if you did have a problem accessing it, after the call, just reach out to us and we'll get the materials to you in another way. Most of you know ARS for a particular strategy. You may be interested to know that we offer a broad range of investments that span across six different asset classes. And it's this broad range of investments that give us the opportunity to meet the unique investment needs and profiles of our clients. For those of you that had the opportunity to join our recent calls, you'll know that we focus on our high conviction, growth-oriented strategies, which are designed to compound capital over time. And with high reward typically comes higher volatility. So today, we'd like to talk about some of our other strategies which complement the growth-oriented strategies by providing a portfolio with lower volatility and the opportunity to generate better risk-adjusted returns. As Stephen mentioned, I'm going to take the next few minutes to talk about ARS's ETF strategies before turning it over to Roth. And at ARS, we offer ETF portfolios through two distinct approaches. The first is what we call our tactical sector ETF strategy. And let me highlight some of the characteristics of the tactical sector strategy. The portfolios are constructed with a long-term view, which are consistent with our outlook. The investment process results in lower portfolio volatility when you compare it to the major indices. And the portfolios have relatively low turnover, making it a very cost-efficient approach. We have six model portfolios, each with various levels of risk and reward. When you look at the allocations, they run the spectrum. On one end, it's all equity, to the other end being all fixed income. And each of the portfolios are diversified through broad market and geographical exposures. And let me just touch on a little bit of the history we have in ETF portfolio management. We began managing ETF portfolios back in 2013. The portfolios were designed for clients of a bank's trust department. And actually, many of the clients are court-mandated trusts where the courts have to sign off on the investment process that we're providing. So our goal going in was to provide a portfolio solution that both the courts and the bank's trust committee were comfortable with. And our solution was a portfolio that delivers market-like returns with lower than market volatility. In doing so, we take into account the risk tolerance of the client, and within the portfolio guidelines, we overweight and underweight targeted sectors based on our outlook by a maximum of 10% plus or minus the sector's index weight. The guidelines also give us the ability to opportunistically invest a limited portion of the portfolio in non-index exposures, specifically in U.S. small cap and mid cap stocks, as well as international stocks. The result is you get a well-diversified portfolio with the flexibility through the different models to match the different client profiles. So that's our tactical sector ETF. I mentioned we have two approaches. The second approach is what we call our focused ETF strategy. And given the success we had on our tactical sector calls, we launched the focused strategy in 2017. The portfolios are also constructed with a long-term view consistent with our outlook, but this is a high conviction portfolio. Think of it as best ideas reflecting our strongest secular views with weightings that are aligned with that conviction. We utilize sector ETFs as well as industry ETFs, and that's a key difference in the approach. For example, Stephen mentioned within our outlook, we have a favorable view of defense stocks. If defense stocks fall into the industrial sector, along with transportation stocks, machinery stocks, construction stocks, and others. So instead of investing in the industrial sector to get that exposure in the focused ETF portfolio, we invest directly in the aerospace and defense industry ETF to better reflect the exposures we want to achieve. So within the ETF strategies, the focused ETF is the one that's most closely aligned with our outlook. Now, I'll wrap up here with just a couple of final thoughts. The ETF platform, in our view, is a very efficient way to tailor your portfolio risk profile through the different model allocations. And for investors just getting started, if you have children or grandchildren that you're funding an account for, the ETF strategies are a great way to build a portfolio at lower levels of capital. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Ross.
Thank you, Sean. Historically, the equity market is upwardly biased. It tends to be up about 70% of the time, but it's that fear of the other 30% of the time that seems to dominate many investors' thinking. These pullbacks can often cause investors to question the long-term investment strategy that they had previously put in place, which can compound the damage that's been brought on by a market decline. Our core investment strategy is designed for clients who want to participate in the upside offered by the long run in the equity markets while cushioning some of the downside risk inherent when one invests in equity markets. Like all our strategies, core is driven by the secular trends we see driving economic activity over the near to intermediate term. The underlying trends we see are generally secular in nature, although some can be cyclical. They tend to need to be of a long enough expected life that they can offer us a chance to invest in them instead of just trade around them. We also expect them to be powerful enough that they will reward businesses that are key players or early movers in the trend, but will also draw in investors who want to take advantage of this situation when they see that the wind is at their backs. Many of our peers focus on getting the highest possible yield as a tool to dampen downside volatility in a portfolio. We have found that this runs the risk of sacrificing both downside protection and upside protection because it can result in a portfolio populated by companies with weaker finances, and those weaker finances not only endanger their ability to grow the company,
but they can also endanger the ability to grow the dividend or even sustain the dividend under certain circumstances. Our approach is to focus on individual investments. These investments that make up the portfolio are the kinds of companies we think Warren Buffett would tell you you want to focus on. They're companies that are leading players in their industry. They tend to have growing market share or hold a commanding space in their segment. They have strong balance sheets, reasonable earnings growth. We like them to generate good free cash flow, which they use to pay above average dividends, and they give them strong prospects for future dividend increases. What's made this strategy a success over time is not just the types of stocks that we populate the portfolio with, but also how we put them together as a portfolio. Our core strategy, to take away the investment speak, is designed to have portfolios which go up when the market goes up, but generally not as much, and go down when the market goes down, but hopefully meaningfully less than the market falls over any sustained down period. Going back to when we started this strategy in 2011, it has captured nearly 85% of the market's up moves while suffering only a bit over 60% of its down moves. With low turnover, making it a fairly tax-efficient strategy, it tends to have a very attractive total return after tax, although investment fundamentals, not tax avoidance, drive investment decision-making. This means that over the period from 2011 to 2018, this portfolio has been able to go up for about 85 cents on every dollar the market's gone up during up cycles and lost only 60 cents for every dollar the market has fallen during its down cycles. We think that's an attractive structure and return structure. There are differences between our core strategy and the other strategies which are more growth-oriented. We use more names in core, 35 to 40. The portfolio makes use of a wider array of industry sectors than our more growth-oriented strategies. Also, every name in core has to pay a dividend. This means that we make less use of younger or faster-growing companies, which often focus their free cash flow on growing the business instead of paying dividends. While this can dampen some of the upside opportunity in a portfolio, it also helps capitate the downside risk. Regarding individual names, most of the holdings are names that you will know. Things like Microsoft, Apple, and Cisco representing technology and the Internet of Things trend, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Merck representing healthcare, with Raytheon and Northrop representing defense. But some might be a little less well-known to you, including two special situation names. The first of these is Newell Brands, whose portfolio includes a lot of products you do know, things like Rubbermaid, Coleman, Graco, and Yankee Candle. Newell's in the process of a major restructuring. It's looking to raise between $8.7 and $9 billion through asset sales. They've been using proceeds from these sales and will continue to use proceeds to pay their debt down. They've currently paid it down from nearly $10 billion to about $8.7 billion, and they hope to move it down to $7 billion when they've completed this program. Additionally, as they pay the debt down and they continue to raise cash from asset sales, they have said they're going to buy back shares. We expect they could buy back a third or more of their shares, which will help offset the dilution that's going to be imposed through the asset sales. The sell-side outlook for Newell is very mixed. Many analysts see that the company's earnings per share and free cash flow will fall after the asset sales on a per-share basis, while others believe the company will actually see both those measures go higher. We're in the latter camp, along with one investor who you might have heard of, Carl Icahn, who at the end of last year upped his stake to just under 9.9%. As an aside, Carl Icahn's son is actually, Carl placed his son on the board of the company last year, so the Icahn family is pretty heavily invested in the future for Newell. Newell has a 4.25% yield, and the street sees it as having an upside about 14% above its current price. We believe, though, that it can generate a total return of more than two times that, giving us a potential total return of roughly 30% as they execute their strategy. Another stock that's a special situation in our portfolio is probably also not particularly well known. It's Constellation Brands. It's the world's largest premium wine distributor, and it's the third largest beer distributor in the U.S. Late last year, the company made a major investment in the shares and options of Canopy Growth. The market's not quite sure what it thinks about this investment, and the stock sold off after they made it. We used the post-deal weakness to initiate a position in Constellation. After they announced their deal, they also announced a plan to reduce debt using internally generated free cash flow and the sale of some of their lower-margin domestic wine brands. The market's also been concerned about a slowdown in domestic beer sales for Constellation's competitors, although Constellation has so far found that they've not had any trouble with keeping their revenues and earnings growth in the beer segment hot. With a 1.7% yield, Constellation's attraction to us is more about the upside we see in the shares than as an income vehicle. The street consensus sees an upside price target of about 210. It's currently trading around 173. But bulls on the street, and we count ourselves among them, see it being worth up to or above $250 a share, which is more than 50% above its current price. As you can see, the portfolio has many diverse names in it. We think it's very well positioned from an opportunity standpoint going forward. It currently has a yield of approximately 3%, which is about 100 basis points better than that of the S&P 500, while the upside to consensus sell-side targets is over 12% at current prices. That gives us a targeted return of 15% plus over the next 12 months for this strategy. I'll hand it back to Stephen to wrap things up now.
Thanks, Rose. We did have two questions from listeners that I want to quickly address. One was, do we think that investors are too complacent about the ability of the U.S. and China to strike a deal? And the answer to that is for January when the market was going up, I think they were. The reaction today to Mr. Kudlow's comments that we might not and the decline in the market gives an indication that people are nervous about it. It's very difficult to handicap the actual outcome of that, but safe to say from our remarks today that we're not complacent about it. The second question we had relates to the topic of income inequality, which has been getting a lot of ink lately, and more specifically, the role of the Fed's policies in contributing to income inequality, particularly their zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, which tended to penalize savers and retirees and benefit the people who own equities and who have many assets. Our approach to dealing with issues like this would be to focus more on what are the causes of the problem of income inequality rather than where should the blame go, because I think throughout our history, when we look to find where there's blame, it's usually not as simple as putting it in one spot, such as the financial crisis had many fathers. We think that income inequality, which is an issue that's been going on for some time and building for some time, is a result of a series of issues in the country. A lot of it stems from education, our reaction to globalization, and other policies that would be beyond the Fed's control. So we think there are social problems that we have to deal with that are creating this. We think there are educational issues that have to be focused on job skills. So it's not all about sending people to college, but we have 6 million jobs open right now or more that we can't fill due to lack of skills, and the same issue applies in other countries. So when we think about income inequality, we think of it on many dimensions, but really would wish the dialogue, particularly in Washington, instead of focusing on one-off statements, would be more focused on understanding the root causes and addressing them as we move forward. So we thank you for your questions. Let me close by saying that we live in a world that focuses a lot on short-termism and sound bites, whether it's from politicians or the media. Sound bites are great to sell views and sell stories, and in the media's case, they love to use crisis headlines to improve ratings. We think this oversimplifies the causes of market moves and complex problems like we just discussed with income inequality, and also understates the complexity of the relationship between the chaotic political environment we're experiencing, the slowing and different uneven pace of global growth, and then the changing structure of the markets. But as Russ touched on, the story you don't hear enough when you turn on the news or pick up the newspapers is that investing with a longer-term approach pays off, with the market posting positive returns in 71.5%
of the past 193 years. And in the last 70 years, we've delivered in the U.S. equity markets over 8% returns annually. So while we have no idea what the market will do from day to day or from quarter to quarter, we're confident that our investment capabilities, our time-tested investment process, the experienced investment professionals like I have joining me on the call today, and our active management approach works to build and protect capital. We believe that investors should have portfolios that match their risk tolerance and goals. At ARS, one of the key things we pride ourselves on is providing the same standard of care to our clients that we would to our own families. It's an important differentiator that people should be treated the same way you want your own families treated, and we feel that far too many institutions don't do that today. We thank you for joining us on the call today. We value your time and feedback and appreciate our relationship with you. Please call if you have any questions or to learn more about the strategies we discussed today. Have a great day. Thank you.
That concludes our conference. Thank you for choosing the event conferencing enhanced. You may now disconnect.